Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
Did Winston Churchill actually write science fiction? Now, Winston Churchill's the famous leader of Britain during the Battle of Britain, World War II. His famous speeches, "We will fight them on the beaches, we will fight them everywhere." I can't quite remember what it was. Various rousing speeches he was able to give. There are pictures of him in a coat with a bowler hat and a cigar, smoking, always having whiskey, a real man's man who led Britain through its darkest hour. And there's been many documentaries on him. And we know sort of certain things about him. So if at various stages... I suppose I've encountered him in person, but in terms of bronze person, in a bus in front of a place called Winston Churchill House on Canberra's Northbourne Avenue. There's a bust of him, little garden. And I go back and that's been demolished and the statues have been demolished. But around the world there are these statues to the great man of Britain. And little by little things uncover with him. So he was his... was very much involved as a war correspondent. A famous part of the Churchill legend brings up. And if you can imagine, you're doing archaeology and you scrape things away. And indeed, what happens is, with all archaeology, you are uncovering two things. One is you're uncovering the area back in time, but you're also uncovering your own society. You're trying to actually map the information of the past to some extent into your current society, because by doing that you get the money. If you just wanted to map the past, you wouldn't get money to keep on digging. You have to say how it's relevant and to constantly tune. So it's a two-level thing. So similarly here, going back, there's a two-level thing. Whereas I find, discover the real Winston Churchill, then I make discoveries about the society I am at. And it's more the needs of my current society, their need for Winston Churchill to be a certain type of character, and a need not to ask any further questions. There's a need for stillness in inquiry. People say, basically, "Oh, I know him from the cartoons, a few documentaries, things which I'm comfortable with, and that's about it. I really don't want to know any more. Can we move on? Can we not investigate this?" And that's coming at this end. This is understanding what society is today. Now, there are always social misfits, and I'm a bit of a social misfit being a research scientist, where I find something, I go in and I dig deeper, read deeper. Now, haven't always done this. You can't dig everywhere. You've got to sort of be like a pig hunting truffle. You see a bit of a smell and you move, and when you dig, you just can't dig everywhere. You've got to dig in front of a truffle. But so before the truffle stage, I began to pick up a bit more about Winston Churchill. Pretty much in the sort of stuffing story they'd say about how he was in South Africa and reported on the Boer War and various things. And he was a war correspondent. A bit like that. And you hear a little bit later how he's re-elected after World War II. He was chucked out and brought back in for a bit. And did he perform well? It was sort of a bit strange. And he died. So he was sort of... You get that sort of information. And then reading about the Gallipoli campaign... it's something a bit more close to home. So, at the start of World War One, Britain, in terms of grand ideas, was going to send its powerful navy of the Mediterranean through the Dardanelles, another little sea, and then there's a very tiny strait which you can build a bridge across, almost a river, between Istanbul, which is in Asia Minor, and Istanbul, yeah, it used to be called Constantinople, and on the opposite side, Greece and the rest of that. And if you could send your ships straight in there, you could blast Turkey and win the war. And of course Turkey had different ideas, and what had happened is, so this is a grand plan of the Admiralty, for some reason a hussar, Victorian hussar officer, we don't know at this stage, but we know he was First Lord of the Admiralty, and he organised the Gallipoli campaign. So the British ships went to bombard Constantinople. Now, most people don't know this. Most people don't know this part of it. But so you research, you dig in deep, and you're sort of talking about other things. And the Turkish had mined the Dardanelles, the first sort of strait as you come across. So if you see the map of Turkey, it's a big sort of rectangle. The left upper part of the rectangle almost touches Europe, and Europe comes down, and there's a gap there called the Dardanelles. And then on the right side of the triangle, it really almost touches Europe again, and then behind it is the Black Sea. So, and that the Black Sea scoops down, making it sort of Turkey, the Aegean and Mediterranean, also the Mediterranean, there's a section of the Mediterranean between Greece and Turkey is called the Aegean. Then you've got the Black Sea, and above it, and so the Mediterranean is on the left and underneath, and it's sort of it's about a quarter or third of the bottom right hand of the rectangle. Connects to the rest of Syria and all that type of stuff, and comes down. Very important. If you want to have a crusade, you have to get through Constantinople. So that's a very important point. And this is part of a key strategic area of the Roman Empire. In fact, the Roman Empire really shifted its focus to Constantinople, moved its empire, its seat of power from Rome. And the Roman emperors, when they did exist, had a greater support there. It was strategically easier to defend than Rome, which was, had a huge, you could invade from all different points to get to Rome. So they moved it there. So there's a big historic story, Christian story of going there, a sort of romance of going there, and Britain steamed up saying, we've got mines, they've got mines, the howitzers and forts either side. The Turkey sort of had this one hot spot and then to defend itself. And of course Britain lost a third of its battleships, and they made no progress, they just blew up. And a few submarines made it through, the Holbrook, Commander Holbrook. So we have our city of Holbrook in Australia, celebrating the submarine commander who actually did get through, and they're able to sort of pick off a bit of Turkish shipping here and there. And we have in Australia a town in the middle of nowhere. Like it's not in the middle of nowhere, it's well, hundreds of kilometres inland, and 100 kilometres inland is a submarine, and they have a submarine there. And it was, from what class, a submarine there. It's Holbrook submarine, and Holbrook was renamed after this World War I submarine commander, because it was originally called Germantown, because the Germans were, not all Germans are German, and so the Germans that came out to, earlier to Australia before World War I were refugees, and then they split again and they formed a little community, a Germantown community, and there was a whole series of de-Germanification of Australian places, names, as part of patriotism for World War I. There's a whole series of things that happened in Australia, lots of intrigues and political things. But one of the things is that the fresh Australian and New Zealand forces were put in a grand sweeping action, and they were to be landed at the Dardanelles. Now, and they landed basically just at the sort of mountains, and they landed on the sea to mountain front, and were pinned there in an area of just a few city blocks for a year. Gallipoli, a huge loss of life. Nothing compared to the future battles of World War I. And militarily, you look at it and you say, if they went just a few kilometres further up, which they were trying to do, but even further up than that, they could have just cut the supply lines. So in essence, it was ill-conceived. And for this, Churchill got the sack. So Churchill organised it, killed a couple of Australians, got the sack. And so, as an Australian, you're going, let's have a look at that. And then his mind of invasion, he sort of got the Americans to invade Italy first, and through the soft underbelly of Europe, which is the Alps. You know, it's like he all never learned. And the Americans went along that, huge loss of life and really unnecessary. Then he had a failed campaign where he repeated this in Dieppe with the Canadian sort of, as my son puts it, D-Day light, where with not enough air power, not enough troops, he just got a few Canadians to get killed going across to fight the Germans. And so you really question this person. And so this is going back into history, but to the current day, people don't go that far. And if you go that far, it's a bit unusual. And I was reading a book, as one does, called Chasing the Sun. And in Chasing the Sun, they had a section on the sun and science fiction, because part of the sun and science fiction is these fictional ideas about the sun. And it went on and said that Churchill was a friend with H.G. Wells, and H.G. Wells is the key science fiction writer of the time. So he wrote War of the Worlds and The Time Machine, and The Time Machine was able to physically take people forward to see the Earth as the sun was dying. So, this is a fairly incredible story. And also, reading it, if you read The Time Machine, it's well written, but it's also in this, it's not written as you would expect a novel today. Sort of a novel today. It's really interesting because a novel today doesn't have such clear cinematic description. Why? Because we have the cinema to do it. And this is part of the differentiation of genres. So if you look at the very early films, the films didn't understand they were a film, and they would still have the theatrical direction, so that people would walk up to into a scene and say, oh, look, a stair. Now, obviously, if you are cinematic, you can just see the stair, but they would still giving verbal descriptions. So these verbal, we've become less verbal, less and more conceptual in our ideas. But it is interesting that well-written stuff is written back. And so there's the big question of science fiction and Churchill. And as I said, you're looking to the past and the present. And in the present, you're very much aware that people at the present don't want to speak to you personally. You're abandoned a little bit. But they've also abandoned any deep look into these cultural things because it's inconvenient, fundamentally, to find that what they have based their idea is factually incorrect. If they're not committed to general discussion anyway, the last thing they do is want to have someone actually go in and pick something up. Which is, if you're in that genre, that's okay, but if you're a research scientist, you have to say, take a little bit of a different attitude in terms of, yes, it's about majority of research, quite realistically, majority of research funding is a lot of money spent, and only a very tiny fraction of it is worthwhile, but that fraction is worthwhile and it grows up. The rest of the time is unworthwhile, and you've got to it to analyze the full amount of information. So if you make an error is still valuable because it gives you information. You have researching obliquely into, not directly, but obliquely, Churchill's been in the background. When you read this Chasing the Sun, and it says that Churchill wrote a science fiction novel, Savarola. That's the name of the novel. He wrote one fictional novel, Savarola. And you say, oh, well, that is an important turning point, because there's certain science fiction stories. There's Parmenides, which is something that's not generally known. It's something that I've researched and found, the initial ones. There's another science fiction one, which this book turned up, and it's quite absolutely correct. It's a 130 AD one of visiting the sun and the moon and stuff like this, wacko. There's another science fiction one which came up again, which is Kepler. Apparently wrote a science fiction story. All very intensely interesting, all completely blow away our picture of scientific progress. Because a picture of scientific progress is very much rarefied of people who accept things, a small group of accepted things. There's a whole lot of other imaginings either side. So it was very interesting to go forward. These things, Francis Bacon, very important thing. And I'll just go through a sequence there. At the time, Francis Bacon wrote a science fiction called New Atlantis. And it's got a whole lot of important things, because it describes a southern land, you could say near where Australia is, and it's got this religious view to it, and it's got a scientifically based society, which is the precepts for the American Constitution and the Royal Society, all based here, and it's also the precepts to Jonathan Swift's science satire. So it's sort of like the germ there, and you research it in. Now, as with archaeology, you've got things you find out, and the present time, and with finding things out, my daughter was studying science fiction as a genre, and I said, her earliest science fiction was 1930. I said, oh, no, I don't think it is, and a friend, in inverted commas, a friend, came in and shut that down and said, look, I said about Francis Bacon, and this friend said, oh no, Francis Bacon didn't write any of his own work, it was all written by Shakespeare. And I sort of objected, and I was put down. I was put down, how could I say this, because the person saying it had an English degree many years ago, but still nonetheless an English degree. And as I produced weeks later the actual, went back, I said, well, perhaps I'm wrong, perhaps this is true, but I think it's more I didn't say at the time, but I think it's more the idea that Francis Bacon wrote some of Shakespeare's work is one of the views, and it turned out to be true. But when I brought the actual book, showed the book that Francis Bacon had written, I was shouted down. How come I was not accepting the official view? And accepting the official view is sort of just not something that one does. And finally, the clincher came when I began to cogitate the times in my head, and Francis and Shakespeare died in 1660, and Francis Bacon died in 1626, and only began working on the book in 1622. So, even if I sort of accept that you can't challenge authority, you can say, well, Shakespeare couldn't have written Francis Bacon because he was dead at the time. And it's this very low level of stuff. So nonetheless, if you are reading your sources and realise that, you know, you've got to be very careful. So this is a bit different from received declarative knowledge. That is, I declare it's this way, I've got a degree, a lecturer told me, therefore I have the authority, even though I myself may not have submitted a very good essay on it or really understood much of the course. Once I get through, I can, now I've gone through a ceremony that allows me to declare. That's a different type of knowledge from good, hard, long research. So, on the short is Savarola. I sort of look at it, I'm about to give away my book, so I better research various things, make sure I've got them right before I give my book on. This is one of the great things with the books, is that you can, they're there, it's so un-internet, and once you've finished with them, there's really no point in storing them. You ship them off to someone else. I'm about to ship it off to someone else, this book. So Savarola, you look at it and you say, this is a science fiction book. And why it's a science fiction book, declaratively, is that this book, when I say declared, you haven't tested it directly, you are using declared knowledge, that you, this book has declared it so. And some of the internet sites have said that this referred to Winston Churchill as a science fiction writer, but it's unclear what's going on. And the actual story is actually quite fascinating to go ahead and a salutary lesson. So the book, I get the book and I say, well, I've just podcasted nearly 700 page book, and it's all worthwhile. I doubt that anyone has really bothered to listen to it. And coming back to it, I say, well, this is an 87 page book, but the 87 pages are really small print, so it's probably 180 pages, you know, of a normal book read. And you're reading through it, and it's 22 chapters, 24 chapters. So the chapters are mercifully short. And you're reading along, and you say, this is going to be a science fiction book. And you read it, and of course, when you're reading it, you have, we will fight them on the beaches. Blah, blah. I really wish I could remember. I used to listen to Winston Churchill speeches. They were all, blah, blah, blah. And you start reading it, and you go, this is just, firstly, it says he was a member of the Hussar Lancers, the British Army. So the British Army at the peak of the Victorian period. So he was a Victorian officer. And the British Army could do no wrong. And he dedicates it to the Hussars, which are, Hussars are sort of light infantry, the sword. They've got no story there. And he writes this book called Savola. So Savola is the main character. When I read the first book, podcast, I'm going to read the others, because I began to say, when you read it, you say, it's going to be a real shock, it'll be a real genius if he can actually convert this to science fiction from this first chapter. Then going back, reading it, I began to read through it a bit, scan it, and indeed, shock horror, there is no science fiction in it whatsoever. And there's a false piece of information given from the declared knowledge, which is interesting because that's what a researcher does. They go through declared knowledge and pick out what's correct, what's incorrect, and get a quality view rather than a positional view, a social view. People like declared knowledge to take a position on it and use it to have power, which is really not what a research scientist does. So I began to research into it. So I have mercifully only said to a few people, I'm fascinated by this book. It's supposed to be a science fiction book. And indeed, it turns out not to be. But what it is far more fascinating. Well, fascinating in that Churchill describes in the very first scene fighting a dictator. Right? The dictator has scrambled democracy and upset people. And in the very first scene, he gets his soldiers to fire directly into the crowd with soft point bullets. Now what's happened is that soft point bullets got banned as a war crime thing because they expand into people. And people were just beginning to do these things. And he has this clinical military experimentation. These people are not properly connected with each other, and you read into it. And there are these various things, and you say, I wonder who that is. And so you read in, and there's the necessary thing that the leader gets hit by a stone and bleeds, and therefore it's not completely one way. There was a bit of a risk, but they shoot and kill 40 people. Now, of course, you're rather sensitized to this because this is what has happened. The shooting, the story of shooting and killing innocent people it's a sort of like a massacre, but it's obviously what's happened in Christchurch. So it's almost impossible to read this at this stage because you're a bit sensitized to mass shooting. So in the southern hemisphere around here, we had a mass shooting back at Port Arthur in 1986. We banned all guns, and so practically no one can have a gun without being reported to police. That's what it is at the moment, unless you're in a group that knows it. And so it's all over. And in New Zealand, they had this mass shooting, and within 24 hours, started the banning of all guns. And like Jacinda Ardern says, you can still buy them if you want to, but you have to put an application to a register to the police. And I can tell you at this stage that it's not going to happen. It's so beautifully put. However, let's go back. And you start reading it, and there's the basic narrative, which you go, oh, this narrative is very, very similar to the Venezuela narrative, which is very similar to all the narratives. Now, the thing with narratives is that the people outside and the people inside can actually get absorbed into it. And you're reading certain things, and certain things don't happen. And there's a spirit of compromise, which is reading in 1897 to 1899. It was published as a book in 1899. But it really reads like the start of World War One, as well as World War Two, to go across. Then there are other things. There's a Lucille, this broad, and you can really see it's the way of we would call it sleaze, and we'd probably call the Me Too movement. But he was saying, oh, she was a beautiful woman, and she had the feminine, beauty of youth, but that flower when the woman becomes more womanly, which is okay. It's sort of a bit confusing here because you're looking at the Me Too movement, yet you have the erotic shots of people on the screen, and we have this is really rather different because you've got the literary sexuality, whatever that is within the zone, and then you've got the social sexuality. There's all these different sexualities, and you get confused about what exactly should happen. But it really stands out when you read that system transferred back to 1899. You say, oh, disgusting. Not really disgusting, but then you read a little bit more. Winston Churchill, who was describing his own mother as this character. And the interesting thing is that the Savoy is actually Winston Churchill, and he describes his study, and he's read all these books. But has he really read all these books? Because he's really only read H.G. Wells, as far as I can see. And he just refers to knowledge groups. Now, again, you sort of say, that's very similar to I've got a degree in English back in the 1990s from some remote Australian university, and I can say things, or I've got that book on the shelf, and therefore I have that authority, that sort of declarative authority, whereas it's a lot tougher to actually read through, and you're limited to your own skill, unfortunately. One of the things of non-declarative knowledge is that if you're slow, or if you had neuro damage or anything like that, you just have to accept, well, mate, that's the way it is. partly because, and also it's pretty much an advantage not to have friends to talk with, because you can't fool yourself. So you can the problem with fooling a friend is that you can fool yourself. It's hard to say. When I read a philosophy book, go through, I get the general gist, and there's a few points which lead me to research others, and eventually I'll come back to it. So it will take me 3 or 4 years to understand Pythagoras and Leibniz. I don't that I understand it. When I refer to Pythagoras and Leibniz, Pythagoras drew the circle with a dot, which is the atomic symbol, and Leibniz extended this idea of number and God and came up with binary statistics and binary, which is our digital age. Now, I haven't really I have beginning to understand more, but I've only scratching the surface, and it's the quality which you go into. Similarly here, I'm not an expert on Winston Churchill. However, it is absolutely weird seeing an insight to what the image he's projecting of himself, which he successfully has done, and everyone has accepted him. He's got his mother, and his mother is, Lucille is the broad or dame with the dictator. The dictator's sort of come off the boil as power is corrupted. And it's really interesting from a science perspective that by just monitoring empathetic statements of a person, you can actually see. I think they did a study of Obama, and 7 months in, he began saying, "I'll send my drones after you," sort of jokingly, that dehumanization is part of it. And perhaps unhuman demands of running a society. So a conventional society is inhumane. And the reason I would say that is that until very recently, it was all based on slavery. And so your exploitation of nature is one thing, but the other thing is that it's a combination exploitation of nature and humanity. I think those two went together to build us where we are. Now we don't have to exploit. Our technology means that we can pull off exploiting nature and pull off exploiting other people and live well through technology. That's one of the things. However, your ability to exploit nature, you essentially have to have a different attitude. If you see a deer, you have to surround it, kill it. Okay, that's not very empathetic to go forward. And so there's this dehumanization. And so if you want to be in charge of a group, you essentially have to say, you have to make your differentially valuable to join the group. So if you're outside the group, you are by yourself, so you're out with the wolves, you've got to low the value. And so that process, social process, where you are getting social value is in there. So that's my view about how dictators or any person in management can go off the boil, basically someone who's off the boil already can get a fast track into management and become a psychopath. So coming in through there, it's Savarola. And so there's a series of things, and then Savarola is so good, he becomes a threat to the state. They asked him to, this is reading crudely, threat to the state, Savarola, we will sue for peace, although they have been completely fracturing it all the time. Of course, this not being a nice person is part of human control of other humans, which has led to our wealth. You know, we are here, we are built on the slavery and suffering of a huge number of people. You know, maybe oppressed people, oppressed aboriginals, dispossessed people, it's all over the place. So they said, we want to get Savarola peace. He escapes, but he escapes with Lucille, his mum, okay, but his idealised wife who's, and it's a real Victorian lady. Oh, you're so good. Oh, and I'm so feminine. Oh, dear. He escapes, and they said, well, if you don't hand him over, we will bombard. The Navy's out there and bombards him. And you go, like, from pretty much, you pick up, it's not going to be science fiction. No aliens, no mention of space, nothing scientific, the whole lot. End of story. What is the story? But so we've got now Churchill. Now, this Churchill is a science fiction-driven imaginer. So he's imagined certain things which are science fiction, crazy. And that one of them he imagined is landships. Landships, these are naval guns which can actually travel along the gun, the things, ships that can actually travel over land. And of course, they are the tanks. So Winston Churchill's vision and support has actually given us mechanized warfare. Thank you, Winston. Then, reading further out, there's this obvious point here. So you can imagine that in terms of this other author, Richard Cohen, has been looking there, and he smelt truffle and is sort of dug in the wrong place a little bit. So that's okay. But going in the same place, you say, "Oh, is there a truffle at the end of that hole?" No, there's not. But then the angle is another angle. So Winston Churchill came up with a few wacko ideas, one is air mines. So these are mines suspended on a parachute. They drop down ever so slowly, and with great cost, the British used these and knocked out 8 German planes, which is might be sound a lot, but in the Battle of Britain, they were losing hundreds a day. It's this type of stuff. And he also had the idea of iceberg as unsinkable aircraft carriers. And yeah, which is we will fight them. So these are pure science fiction fantasies. And he was the first prime minister or to have a science advisor. There is say that you've got these various fantasy things. You've got Hitler and von Braun seeing the fantasy. Yeah, there's all these fantasy stories. And he came up with a few other innovations. So he was not scientifically literate. He was science fiction engaged, which is better than a whole lot of other people. So this is an interesting dimension, and this is what goes forward. So people, it's almost as though this is down a rabbit hole and at an angle, which is invisible, because people will still say, "Oh, I know him doing his victory sign on the battleship of the whatever the Yalta thing." Don't trust Stalin. There's another dimension to Churchill. He organised the partition, the bloody partition of India. And as you read it here, he sees it's sort of unnecessary. He's really unmoved by common people killing each other. He thinks that's just part of society. It really comes through the Savala, and then you see what's happened to India, poor India. And what's also interesting is that his fiction, Victorian fiction, there's a whole class of fictionalized Middle European powers which have certain attributes. It's called Ruritania, and it's a high art that came around at that time. But that Ruritania is the fundamental of Genovia and Princess Diaries, that genre. But that genre came across with certain things that led to certain series of sea invasions and technologies going forward, this basic support of technology really swapped the war over. And interesting that the nuclear age is a science fiction. Nuclear bomb is a science fiction bomb of H.G. Wells. So it's sort of like, this is fairly intentional. So that culture clashed with the German Teutonic culture of Wagner and Schopenhauer, and they used to dress up in operatic uniforms and a lot of the speaking was operatic, like the large, basically Hitler's speeches were sort of spoken opera to the German ears. So you see these two big broad cultural things going forward, and you see it come through, and the whole sequence of where people, this doesn't control things, but I think it does give a certain inertia, the way that Germany kept on expanding. They sort of repeated their mistakes the second time through from World War One to World War Two. Kept on expanding, but they also had the burning of the bunker, which was out of a Wagnerian opera, the Valhalla, going into flames, that type of stuff. So they've got these recurrent structures going through. So these people are really trapped in exploiting. If they exploit their cultural meme, they're sort of bound to it. As these hundreds of people, people get, you can imagine a German farm boy, here's a few bits. How much opera does he go to? Not much. How many? He's out in sticks. You've got to remember that the amount of communication people had, exposure to memes or whatever it is, to documentaries, films, is much less. So in your kid will have had thousands of hours of exposure compared to a couple of hours of going into a cinema and a few people talking together. And for some reason, their antenna is more tuned to these cultural things, and he dresses up in opera uniform and gets shot because he is such and such. And really, when you look at it, that person's probably only at most probably had 12 months to be there, and people have it's incredible to do. But as I said, archaeology is a two-edged sword. Or historic investigation, you're at one stage looking in your past, it's probably three-edged, but most people it's two-edged, and then it's trying to, say, fit it in to what's believed now. And most people say, look, I want to get a HBO documentary, it's boring, it's not engaging, I'll switch it off, and there's sort of not that story there. And they really want Churchill not to have written science fiction, Francis Bacon not to have written, no one to. But it's really interesting that science fiction writing of these people really is upsetting to people, because there is a script. What is this other script doing here? It's this multiple script, and it's interesting that, say, Plato wrote his philosophy in terms of play scripts. So-and-so enters and says this. He says blah, 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 puts down the cup. Hark, they're visiting. Let's make a great feat. Like you're reading, it's not like you're reading a scientific paper. He describes it. And it's really interesting to see what has meant that if you're reading Churchill novel, it is a lot of stage direction and scene direction. And it's amazing to see it. So at certain points, he goes in and describes certain things. Now, I'm just trying to think, there's other ones. There's George Eliot, I can't remember. But there are books that you have read where it is just scene description gone crazy. They describe the scene and they describe as they pan across it. I can't remember. Was it Thomas Hardy? You just read that they're full of descriptions, and so it's interesting to put this all together. So there you have it. The story is that it's simple, and I've learnt to say this, not rather than at the start say give you a conclusion and then you're struggling. The conclusion at the end is that no, indeed. Churchill didn't write science fiction. However, he injected science fiction into a fruitful world which took it as a germ to produce tanks, and eventually he sort of showed the way to the Americans. Gallipoli Deep, they said, well, we're going to do D-Day. He got the agenda of that going, and he had, there was science fiction in his blood, but he actually didn't write it. And moreover, our inability to see science fiction in the past is, it's sort of like you're digging up all these things, and you're digging up an Egyptian tomb, and your mummy, and there's the mummy's mobile phone, and you say, oh, that just doesn't fit into our story. We might put that aside for the moment. It's going to cause a bit of a problem. And really, in that sense, that science fiction is something which really causes a major problem when it's written by Kepler, written by these various people, this need to and this really this need of people. We have this system of producing science, but we have the need to contribute to the imagination behind it. It gives it them, but when it's written them, so I wonder what Kepler's book, Johannes Kepler's book is there. And it's just really interesting to read in all the aspects of it. Now, the final sort of aspect of, like, it's not a simple, if you're waiting for a simple story of it, I've described it. Everyone's interested in news bites. Today and day, they investigated Lehman Brothers and they found they were corrupt. Oh, and that's explained the event. So people really want a simple explanation to explain the event that's unexplained. If it's an unexplained event, they need a new explanation they didn't have before. And then they're back to the same level. But it's not that simple. If you look at science fiction going across there, and science, in its driving force, you have this complex thing going into science fiction. Is just not there. It's much more complex in that there was a supernova, a star blew up. It meant that this was basically a sign from that. They were looking guidance from the heavens. The heavens told them, orbits are off, start a game. So they invested in Tycho Brahe, Tycho. But the Danes, there's something, if you read the Danes, they're always really insane. And there's a Dane, the Danes had given Tycho a castle on an island. And sort of now, you're sort of, I'm beginning to really understand Denmark. My picture of Denmark is different now that I've looked at the maps and really understood it. But I had an island there, and these astronomers were fairly famous, and there was pictures of them on John Digg's wall. And John Digg's was also working on the celestial sphere, the idea that the star may not be, the sky may not be two-dimensional, it may actually be three-dimensional. Something's blowing up or something like that. And Shakespeare, who didn't write New Atlantis because he was dead, did write Hamlet. And Hamlet is set in Denmark. And if you have Hamlet written on one side and Tycho Brahe written on the other, you've got a crazy king, a Lassipor York, all going through, you can draw lines across. And it could be circumstantial, but the other circumstantial evidence is that Shakespeare visited this astronomer, John Digg's, as one of the friends in London. Everyone visited everyone else. You've got to remember that London was less than a million people. So the rich, so there's really poor people. So the non-people really, and this is another thing to try and remember, which has been lost. We've sort of scaled up, but we haven't created good, smooth communication. So back then, a lot of the policies, there were no government departments. Everything wasn't separated out into universe. It was, people would meet, have a social thing of meeting and eating dinners, and a lot of people would meet in taverns and coffee houses, and there's this, so we have the internet, which is sort of keeps us down, but essentially it's really complex. However, that being said, the idea here is that Shakespeare wrote Hamlet really is a story of Tycho Brahe. And again, reading through, you come across this as well exposed things, but it's one of the facts that Shakespeare has written, and Shakespeare's references to the sky and the heavens could be seen as science fiction, as a bit of science fiction. It's not there, but the influence is there. The real story is that a lot of this cannot come out at the moment because people just aren't interested. They're very much interested in keeping people down and having a standard life, sort of buying the next piece of consumer goods, getting the next person off to the next social appointment, but if you look at the status, you'd say, oh, well, that might be the way here, but eventually, if you continue studying and you can make connections and do things like that, things may change. Thanks for listening. I was able to speak for a long time on Winston Churchill. See you soon.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.